Session number 28361, Reel 28.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 28. You were saying that there was no information technology in exercises. It was all done with
China graph pencils
and paper and telephones and
sure.
What about the actual exercises on the ground, the tubes and so forth? Were they being run on the same basis?
They were on exactly the same basis, and one used to go out and do all the phases of war as toots, exactly as they were done before. And they were preceded by a cloth model on the floor of the Allenbrook first, which sort of laid out the principles of the thing, and then you went out and did a toot, and then at the end of the term you'd have a telephone battle where you'd fight through all the phases of war on a telephone battle basis.
Mm. What about battlefield tours? Were they carrying on, or had they been stopped?
No, they were carrying on still. Mm. And I was lucky, because being a Royal Marine, I was part of the 6th Airborne Division team, which had had two commando brigades under command, of course. And so I was privileged to listen to people like James Hill, Napier Crookenden and others, twice, because I went on two battlefield tours. I was there for long enough. And I used to look after a chap called Alan Perry, who'd been involved in the attack on the Merville Battery. And I found it actually a hugely interesting and instructive period. Mm. And I think if people learnt a lot, that certainly I learnt a hell of a lot about warfare from those guys.
Mm. How were they prepared? Did you have cloth model demonstrations of those battles and syndicate discussions before you went out onto the ground, or...?
No, we didn't do that. Mm. I mean, it's a pity. I think it would have helped if we had. Mm. There wasn't enough time. What happened was that there was a general briefing on the Normandy plan in the Allenbrook, so that everybody started from a common basis. And then there was a briefing on the airborne plan, the 50 Div, which was one of the divisions we... And a briefing on Goodwood, which was the other operation that we looked at, in the Allenbrook, with accompanying, film footage of the time. And so over the period of a day before we went, everyone was brought up to a common level of knowledge. Remembering there were a lot of OC students then, or when I say a lot, they were all still there, who might not have had any knowledge of it at all. And we also had a lecture from a chap who'd been an RAMC Major General called Richardson about stress in battle. As well, and then we went across to France and stayed in a village of Cabourg, in various hostleries around the place. Mm. And used to go out every day, and as a DS you'd take your guest speaker in a Land Rover to his stand and sort of set it all up for him. He might want a blackboard with a map on it or something. And then orchestrate the actual thing. So the DS usually described the ground to the audience, and then handed over to his talker, his speaker.
Was there any follow up when you came back?
No. Mm-hmm. I think much more could have been made of them, actually, than was. But I suppose just lack of time.
Yes. How much written work did the students have to do at Camberley in those days? Was it about the same as you had to do?
Yes, they had to write. There was sort of one paper a term which they had to write, and I can't remember what they were about necessarily, which you had to correct. Then there were various exercises they had to do, and those were mainly, preparing op orders and appreciations and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. But there wasn't a great deal of written work. I mean, one wasn't continually reading, correcting people, which I was happy to say.
What do you think was the most effective way of instruction? Was it the syndicate discussions?
Yes, I think the syndicate discussions were probably the most effective. Invented, of course, by, I think, by Bernie Fuller, weren't they, after the First World War?
I think that he tore up all the old papers and started...
I think the old pre-First World War stock consisted of lectures, and that was it.
To a great extent.
To a great extent. There weren't many discussions, and he just said, well, we've got a lot to teach. We can teach each other, because they'd all been in the war, of course.
I think that, you know, that there was a change in the overall atmosphere, that the army was a great deal more rigid and authoritarian and status conscious before the First World War than it was after. A change in the mentality.
And the syndicate discussion was, I think, the best way of instruction.
So you did your 2 years as a DS. Presumably you had a change of syndicate every term.
Yep.
So you came through.
Every term you had a different syndicate. And sometimes you were what's known as swinging.
Does that mean you were free,
you were writing.
Yes. Rewriting the praises.
Rewriting your exercises, rewriting, in my case, the...
Would that be the joint rate?
The joint bit. And also, but I still, when swinging, would go and listen to central lectures and sometimes sit in on other people's syndicate discussions just to keep myself up to speed.
Had the programme of central lectures changed at all? Because it was extremely broad programme, as I remember it, with all sorts of people coming in from things like the mining industry and so on, as well as from relevant military.
Yes, we still had that. And it hadn't changed much from the time I was a student. So we had some trade unionists coming in and people like that. And then did we do... When I was a student, I went down a coal mine. But I did that when I was at Shrivenham. We went on a mini-industrial tour. And we went to a coal mine, I remember.
This was during your...
Compulsory 3 months at Shrivenham. But I'm not. I think they did it then. I don't think we did any what I would call local government or any of that sort of thing. The only visits we did when I was a DS were one to the Navy, one to the Air Force, one to the American Army in Germany.
I was going to ask if there was an overseas tour besides the visit to Normandy.
No, I mean, the only time we went overseas was to visit the US Army in Germany.
What was the purpose of that? Was it just familiarisation with an allied?
I think so. I mean, it was felt there was no point in visiting the British Army of the Rhine, as most of the students had served in the British Army of the Rhine. So it was looking at the Americans doing the same sort of thing in a similar theatre of operations, really.
Was the main concentration of attention there on staff procedures, or was it on operational?
It was on operational. And it was only about a 3-day visit, and it was potluck where you went. I mean, some people went to, an air cavalry regiment, and so it was all helicopters. Other guys went to an armoured infantry regiment. Other guys went to an armoured battalion. So where you went was just potluck, really.
Where did you go? Do you remember?
I went to a, with my students, we only went once, to a, an armoured infantry outfit. I remember they had Bradleys, and they had 113s, and I don't think they had any main battle tanks, and there was some artillery around too. And I think we went to a sort of equivalent of a divisional headquarters and signal squadron.
What did they do? Did they just lay on a succession of briefings?
Equipment demos and things. They didn't do anything very original or exciting.
Not in the field or anything like that.
No.
How did they compare to our outfits, roughly? Were there any significant differences in the way they did things or thought about things?
74-5 this is 74 actually the time I went. They were still in a pretty low state of morale post Vietnam, And I was also looking at them through the sort of eyes that I'd viewed the American Marines through. I was pretty critical, quite frankly. I thought they were pretty sloppy. And they had a lot of women around, I remember.
Women soldiers.
Well, they're beginning to get a lot of women soldiers around. I thought it was a bit of a waste of time, actually, quite frankly. We could have done, we would have done better to have visited them on an exercise or something like that.
You can't always get exercises timed.
No, sure.
Where did you go when you finished at camp?
I then went to command, 40 commando, for 2.5 years. From December 1975 to June 1978.
Army officers often say that the best job in the army is commanding a battalion.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I would agree, absolutely. Absolutely. Best job there is. Because everything stands and falls by how you run it.
What was 40 Commando doing when you joined them? Was
they were about to, I joined them just before we went on Christmas leave, and then right after Christmas leave we were off to go and do a deployment to the West Indies and the East Coast of America to do a series of amphibious exercises in the LPH, the old LPH bulwark. So it was rather exciting to go away for 2.5 months on one's own, within a few weeks of taking over.
74?
I took over in December 75, and we went off in January 1976.
What state was the commando in when you took it over? Was it up to strength?
Yep, it was up to strength. It was in very good nick. They'd had a Northern Ireland tour earlier in 75 in Belfast, and we were due to go to South Armagh in mid 76. So we had a busy year. I mean, that first year I had what was known as a Westland deployment, which was 2.5 months straight back into a combination of getting ready to get new colours and go to South Armagh. So those were the three events for that year.
So you say go to the West Indies and East Coast of the United States.
Yeah.
Had the plans for those visits already been drawn up so that you were in effect?
I mean, I was taking on someone else's plan because it wasn't time for me to go.
Well, that's always what happens.
That was
you
it.
You take over.
Take over someone else's. And it was fine.
Yes.
There's no problems. I mean, it all worked out fine. And then we went across the Atlantic. In this carrier, we flew off onto the carrier from Staden Heights, Plymouth, and then she went across the Atlantic. And our first place we stopped at was Curacao, and I landed everyone there. We went for a quick stroll through the countryside. And then we went to an island called Aruba, where we did an exercise, where we landed by helicopter and had an exercise against the Dutch Marines.
Now, Curacao, what was going on there at that time? Was there any turbulence? What was the reason for going there?
Well, the reason to go there, really, was a naval reason, to sort of tip our hat to the Dutch administration. And Curacao's, I think Curacao and Aruba were independent at that stage, but they had a sort of relationship with Holland, which I can't actually quite remember what it was, but there was a definite colonial feel to the place.
Probably
still.
Probably a defence agreement.
Something like that.
Sort, yes.
And so there were various people that had to be sort of, you know, we're here in your patch, thank you very much. We were only there for a couple of days.
Yeah.
It was mainly social. And then we went to Aruba, which is the first time I'd actually been a CO on exercise.
What's Aruba like physically and generally?
Aruba is very, very rocky, volcanic soil. I mean, really bare, with massive cactus growths, which are absolutely monstrous. I mean, there are some cactus there that that have spikes that long, which will actually penetrate a Land Rover tire. So when you're wandering around at night, if you stand on one of those, it goes 3 or 4 foot.
Spike about 2 inches long?
Yeah. Mm. And when you're wandering around at night, you're brushing up against cactus all the time, and there's another cactus they have which has sort of ears on it, about that size, all covered with spikes, which detach as you're walking past. So you then find that you've got these things sticking all over your legs and sleeves and things like that, and you sit down and you find you're sitting on one or whatever. Anyway, they were bloody unpleasant.
It sounds very uncomfortable.
And it was quite hot. But it was a good exercise. It was a good blow through for me because it was quite a simple exercise. There wasn't anything particularly complicated about it.
What was it? Was it an assault landing?
It was a landing, and then an advance. And I got whole stacks of stuff on it in my album there. But we went up the coast, and then we were continually doing advance to contact against enemy, which got stronger and stronger and stronger. And so we had to put in a commando attack after several company attacks. We were moving by helicopter, and then the next day more of the same, and then the final day I decided that we'd do a night attack, which wasn't sort of on the menu in the sense that they were expecting us to do it the next morning. I thought, well, okay, we won't do that, we'll do something different. We did. And so we did a night approach march and night attack,
and they were kipping
and then we had a sort of fight through battle. But it was a good little blow through for me, as a first time I'd been a CO running a commando. And it was umpired. People were sent out from UK to umpire it.
Was this done over... was this on exercise grounds, or was it...
It was an area that the Dutch used as an exercise ground, because the Aruba is split almost exactly down the middle. On one coast, which is the... I think the east coast, west coast, is the tourist bit with all the beaches. And the other coast is very wild, with huge currents and low cliffs, and very inhospitable for tourists. And there's a place called the Shark Hole, where sharks assemble in a bay, and so you don't go and bathe there and things like that. And it's much more rough, and there are no beaches, and so there's there's no agriculture. There's no way you can till any part of it. So the Dutch Marines used to use it as a training area. And they used it for years as a training area. So the sort of right-hand side of the island, in my memory, maybe the left-hand side, but I think it was the right-hand side, was really a training area. And so there was no conflict with human beings or agriculture or anything like that. And it was, as I say, it was a small, good exercise, which was umpired by guys who were sent out from England specially to do it. So the chap in charge of umpiring me is a chap who'd just been a CO, and the companies were being umpired and that sort of thing. So it wasn't an exercise where you could sort of relax. It was good testing stuff at low level.
So building up from company to commando level.
Yeah, yeah.
What scale were the enemy that you were?
Oh, the enemy was about company strong, I think, something like that. Oh, no. Bit stronger than that, actually. They're about two companies.
How's your headquarters organised, and who's in it? What was the...
Well, it was on its feet. We didn't have any vehicles at all. We were just walking along on our feet with radio, Manpack radios, and it was me. And then I had an ops officer who was an American on loan, actually, an American a Marine on loan, who was very good, actually. A switched on guy. And then I had the RSM and our signalers and the IO. And my BC, my battery commander. Mm-hmm. That was it.
So this is 1, 2, 3, 4 officers, well, 3 officers, 1 warrant officer and signalers. How many signalers?
Well, I had my signaler.
Yeah.
The BC had his signaller, then there was one other signaller on the air net. So probably 3 signallers, 3 radio operators, and then there was a sort of section of protection party.
So altogether there'd be about 15.
Yeah.
Just moving as a blob?
Just walking up the axis. Mm. And then, you know, sort of stopping when we had to. Mm. And the same when we did the night approach march. I remember turning around, it was a time when we thought we'd run into an ambush. In fact, we hadn't had my recce troop out in front finding the way on this particular bit. And I thought we were going to run into trouble, and I turned around to the BC and said, if I become a casualty, you take command. And he sort of woke up and said, oh God, he didn't actually say anything, but because that was obviously the thing, the doctrine or whatever you were teaching was you hand it over to the BC.
Not to the ops officer.
No, because the ops officer was a captain in this case, mm. and the BC was a major, and he was in your mind as to your plan, because you discussed it with him in order to work mm. out your fire plan. And then when he, you know, when possible, the senior company commander came up and took over, but you didn't have a sort of interregnum while everyone was trying to sort themselves out. Might have, both of us might have been killed, but if the CO became a casualty, it was sort of SOP, that so the BC took over.
Okay. So the change of succession would be the commanding officer, then if he was knocked out, the BC, what
yeah.
happened if both of you went?
Well, if both of you went, then the ops officer would have to do it if he was there, and he'd have to call up a company commander to take over.
And then if he went, would it be the IO?
He'd probably. The he'd have to run the show. Mm-hmm. He'd have to shout to one of the company commanders, you better come and take over. You know, mm-hmm. we're all, we've had it, you know.
Yeah. Hmm. What is it that is so particularly good about being the commanding officer then?
Well, you.
Is it the autonomy that you have?
You run it.
Yes.
And you're. You have enormously. You have huge powers for good and bad. Mm. And the commando reflects you, or the battalion reflects the way you run it. And if it's if you're useless, it'll be useless. If you're some use, it'll be not bad. Mm. That's how I see it. It's as simple as that. Mm. And you know, having been in subordinate positions under COs for many, many years, I could see where weaknesses were and how those weaknesses and strengths reflected themselves in the performance of the people under their command. Mm.
Did you regard it as important to keep a close eye on what company commanders were doing? Were you intent on control, or was your approach more one of supervision, allowing
I allowed them to do within limits what they wanted. Mm. I mean, I laid down, later on, when we'd all these exercises had been pre-planned by the people, mm. so I had no control over what we were going to do and what we weren't going to do, except later, towards the end of the series, which I can come to in a minute.
But you were in, you were in command of
way
they were done, which is
Because
you know the script is one thing, but the way the script
oh
is
sure,
out,
I was in control of the way they were done. But
yes.
but my method of command of the company commander was to mm. say you're to do that.
Mm.
I didn't say how he was to do it. Mm. You know, your objective is that.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Mm.
So that's the way I worked.
Mm. What about dealing with the battery commander? Would you be telling him where to put fire us, or in effect consulting him on where the fire ought to go?
I consulted him,
yes.
And I gave him always a free hand to criticise what I was going to do.
Mm.
And I'd worked that same system with my regimental commander when I was a brigade commander.
Mm.
he was very much a sounding board.
Yes.
And then I would say, this is what I want to do.
Mm.
Come up with a fire plan to support it.
Mm.
And I very rarely said, you know, I want fire there, and there. And he knew where the fire should be. Mm. That was his job. And then he'd go away and do it and get it all sorted out.
Mm.
So that, and I did the same, of course, with my mortars, too.
Mm. Did you have a mortar officer?
Yeah, I had a mortar officer.
Mm. He'd be part of HQ company, wouldn't he?
He was part of, well, we had a support company in those
support
days.
Company.
And he'd probably be travelling away, and I used to use the BC to coordinate the mortars as well as the guns.
Ah, so there's a single indirect fire.
A single, yeah.
Did you still have the machine guns at that stage?
No.
They'd gone.
Mm. Support company in those days consisted of the Milan anti-tank mm. troop, as we call it, platoon, the mortars, and the recce.
Oh.
And of course they all operated independently, so support company commander was really at main headquarters, and he was a sort of coordinator who you could use to do things that you wanted coordinated and done. Mm. And he'd move up and join you. So at night, if we went static, the R group, as I called it, which was the mobile bit, would be joined by the rest of the headquarters, and a little CP would be put up. Mm. So you could work at night without flashing lights about the place. Yeah. And so various other people would then come in and join you for that. The two IC, support company commander, who would all end up as sort of watchkeepers during the... And then I'd go and get my head down.
What was the role of the IO?
The IO's job was to collect the intelligence, such as it was, on an exercise. There's obviously going to be intelligence that's fed to you.
Generated by the umpires.
And his job was to collate it and present it to you, and also give the sort of enemy threat, enemy forces paragraph in the at an O group.
Was he responsible for keeping the map board up to date? Was that part of his?
Yes, I mean the map board on the move. The map board was on me.
What was just your?
Just my map. And so the main headquarters, which is another sort of blob of people following behind. Again, they were on their feet.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really a sort of great sort of map board to be kept up. He'd be keeping it up as best he could.
Mm. And the RSM, what was his...
The RSM, I always treat... The RSM's main battle job, of course, is ammunition resupply. Mm. But I used him with me a lot of the time. And he was sort of... Particularly on exercises and training... Because of the personality that he was, both RSMs I had, they were the sort of chaps who would be watching the Marines to see how they were doing their tactics, and were they taking cover properly.
And this is individual battle
skills. You know, were they performing? Were the NCOs? How were the NCOs performing, doing their jobs? And I'd go round a position. When we, you know, went firm, perhaps I would always go round a position because it was training and talk to the platoon commanders and Marines and things like that and discuss with them why had they taken up that position like that. You know, what had persuaded them that that place was better than that place. And the RSM would be very much doing that as well.
Well, you just dug in for overnight defence.
Well, in Aruba, you certainly couldn't dig in because you'd have needed a power drill to get you in. And we were not in position at night for long enough anyway.
So what could you do on Aruba?
All you could do on Aruba was find what was a sort of natural crevice in the rocks.
Yeah.
And use that as the best sort of cover you could find.
Couldn't build sangers?
You could build sangers with bits of the volcanic rock. But quite frankly, the sangers that were built were pretty useless. I mean, you think a proper sanger's got to have a wall that thick. Mm. I mean, it's got to be sort of like that.
Probably
I mean,
you could battered. Have,
there's no way you could have built a sanger like that in that time.
And the ops officer, I mean, what was his
job? Well, his job was to... coordinate. He was a sort of miniature BM, is how I used him.
So he was your business manager.
He was my business manager, and I said to him, "Right, we're going to do a night attack tonight. I'm going to go away and write my orders. You are to send a warning order that the O group is at such and such a time, that we're going to be moving at such and such a time, and the objective is and the likely route." So he would go away and leave me free to think about my plan and talk to the BC about it, while he was doing the sort of minutiae of getting people into the right place, warning off people, you know, bringing up people who needed to be brought up for the next phase, making certain that the administration was the QM was, you know, bringing up water and food and all that sort of thing. He was the staff officer responsible for that.
So you would effectively give him an outline of your intent.
Indeed. Yeah.
For him to put in the warning order.
Yeah.
Then you would concert your own notion of the plan in more detail. Did you do that in written form, or was it just a case of thinking it through so that it was logged into your...
I didn't write out my plan, but I'd write out my orders.
Yes.
Using a, I had a, you know. A